Reports of sand being mined in central Maui and shipped to Oahu for use on construction sites have amplified concerns about the practice from the Maui County Council, which last week adopted a resolution aimed at curbing sand mining and protecting culturally sensitive areas. We're getting in touch with council member of the Maui County Council, Don Guzman. He's the county council member who represents Central Maui. He's on the phone with us to outline the issue. Good morning, council member.
Aloha, Chris. Hi. Thank you so much for having me on NPR.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This is a growing concern, isn't it? How has it come your way?
I just missed the first part of it. Can you repeat the question?
Well, essentially, I said that a recent report of sand being actually shipped to Oahu was kind of the last straw, but it's been a problem that people have been talking about for a while. I just wondered how word of these concerns had come to your office.
Well, it actually came through our council's Infrastructure and Environmental Management Committee, wherein the issue was brought forward through a measure on a temporary sand moratorium.
Mm-hmm.
And when that bill was introduced into committee to be considered, we received testimony from the general public, specifically some organizations that had witnessed this large amount of sand that was being basically extracted from a residential subdivision area that was be constructed, and the sand being transported to a concrete area placed on barges to Oahu.
Something so about it being...
That gave some type of, red flags came up, and we actually had SHPDA, the State Historical Preservation Department, come down to the floor and explain whether there was any monitoring going on. We also had other entities, such as the developers themselves, stating on the council, on the committee, stating that they were within their permit regulations of their grubbing and grading permits.
Mm-hmm.
So we had all this opposing testimony that was placed on the floor, and then eventually, while that was being debated over a series of committee meetings, the organizations and the individuals had filed a lawsuit, and that lawsuit had come to fruition on particular matters on a preliminary injunction. And so when Judge Cardoza eventually made a ruling or opined on the whether or not there should be a preliminary injunction of sand extraction, I took notice of that because of my, my legal background, being an attorney. I took that and all the evidence that was produced in the court case and fashioned the appropriate two bills to address some of the main issues that were being opined in the court case.
Well,
and that was basically clearing up the permitting process on both, as well as the archaeological monitoring plans having more enforcement on that part of it.
Let's just set the stage. Sand gets used in construction projects. It's an ingredient in what? Foundations? Concrete?
Excuse me, can you repeat that?
Why does sand... I want to just set the stage by saying why sand gets mined in the first place.
Oh, okay. Well, in a general sense, there are two types of permits. There's one for grubbing and grading, that's on-site construction.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, most developers and builders go in for that. And then there's a second permit or special use permit that is mining in itself, which is more stringent, and you have to go through all types of regulation and monitoring. And so when at some point in our ordinances, our county ordinances, as they are written, are very vague as to what you can do in a grubbing and grading. And so what was happening in this particular matter was that they were permitted to grade and grub about 213,000 cubic yards, roughly an area of 8.9 acres. And what they were doing was they were extracting that sand and taking that sand to a sand mining company and basically selling it. And then that mining company or that sand concrete company was transporting it to Oahu. Now, they were saying that they were permitted to do so under the grubbing and grading permit, which there is loopholes. And that's why I had to tighten it up and say, look, if you're going to extract that amount of cubic yards, we need to have better definitions of the extraction of mining. So in my definition, I put 100,000 cubic yards in excess of that, then you need to have a permit to mine, as well as, you know, just looking at the facts, you are the developer and you're selling the sand to a mining company. That's mining. I don't care how you call it.
Well, council member,
whatever loophole you call it at, but that's mining.
That's also, there are cultural concerns, right? That if you just...
Oh, yes. And that's the second bill that I had was, or that I proposed, was to enhance the enforcement provisions when those developers or the construction personnel fail to comply with the state and federal regulations affecting archaeological monitoring and the preservation and the mitigation plans, also with the soil and water within a water and soil conservation district. So that bill basically says, let me preface it by saying that in our ordinances, it doesn't give the director of public works who has the authority to revoke the permits. It doesn't give that specific authority to the public director to revoke or deny the permit based off of violations from the state SHPTA, state historical preservation regulations, as well as any violations in the monitoring plan, things like that. It doesn't give that authority directly to the public director to do that. So I went in there and made the amendments to make sure that if any entity doesn't comply with these monitoring archaeological plans, as well as the other state and federal regulations, then that gives the authority of the public director to revoke and fine the entity that is violating those regulations. So,
well, Councilmember,
these two bills are basically, they're not the silver bullet, but basically they're a starting point to clarify our county laws and make them more up to date.
Well, Councilmember,
we've
got to go. We want to keep track of this with you. So thanks very much for talking with us. Don Guzman represents the Kahului Residency area on the Maui County Council and chairs the Parks, Recreation, Energy, and Legal Affairs Committee. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, taking steps to keep truants in school and out of the courtroom. But first, your quiz. Many great storytellers have spent time on the beaches of Hawaii gathering inspiration and material to write about. Today we're looking at an American novelist from Missouri whose novels are famous for their humor, vivid details, and memorable characters. He spent 4 months in the islands in 1866 when he was 31 and working on getting famous. His 25 letters from the Sandwich Islands were while he was on assignment for the Sacramento Union and are still fresh and rudely funny after almost a century and a half. The writer took part in all sorts of Hawaiian adventures that only this area had to offer. He scaled the summit of Kilauea on horseback during an eruption, hiked through misty valleys, and surfed. In his book, Roughing It, published in 1872, this writer shared his experiences surfing in the Kingdom of Hawaii with natives. He wrote, "Each heathen would paddle 300 or 400 yards out to sea, taking a short board with him, then face the shore and wait for a particularly prodigious billow to come along. At the right moment, he would fling his board upon its foamy crest and himself upon the board, and here he would come whizzing by like a bombshell." Today, we want to know the birth name of this famous storyteller. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Habitual truants cause problems for themselves and for their schools, dragging students, parents, and school administrators through a lengthy and frequently unproductive series of court appearances. A pilot project on Kauai, the Truancy Court Collaboration, brings together Waimea High School, Waimea Canyon School, the Hawaii Department of Education, Kauai Police Department, and the Liliuokalani Trust in an effort to intervene early because, as Waimea High Principal Mahina Angre told us the other day, truancy is often a gateway to deeper problems.
Truancy, you're right, it's complex, and it kind of reveals itself in other areas, at least at my school.
Mm-hmm.
So our numbers of kids who are not in school hasn't really gone up, but it's not gone down either.
Mm-hmm.
Since we're such a small school, it really makes a huge difference.
What is your student body?
We're less than 600. We have 577, and that's down considerably from what it used to be like when I was in school.
Mm-hmm.
It was like close to 900 back when the plantations and everything were running out on this side. So as the economy has kind of gone down on this side of the island, the population has also shifted. So the enrollment at the school has gone down, but that's why when we don't have kids in school, and it's hard to teach kids who aren't in school. You know, they miss out on everything, and then you get so far behind, then you know it's almost impossible to get caught up, or they really feel like it's impossible to get caught up.
Yeah,
and it just creates a whole lot of other issues.
How many kids might be truant on a given day out of that 600?
Let me see. Maybe for us, maybe about 10 to 14 consistently truant.
Is it often the same kids?
Oh, yeah. It's almost always the same kids.
And
or the same group of kids. And if you go, like kids who have multiple unexcused absences, you know, then it gets a little bit bigger.
Sure.
But we try and catch them. I mean, we already had somewhat of a program in place, but I'm really thankful that we had the new program that Judge Okobo brought to us from the Waianae coast.
What's different?
We're catching them a little earlier now.
Is that what's different about it, that you're catching them a little earlier?
I think what's different is a more systemic approach.
Mm-hmm.
And we have partners now, and it's not just us trying to figure out how to deal with this. our normal protocol before this was after 5 unexcused absences, we send out a letter to the parents reminding them that, you know, your students should be in school. That's the law.
Mm-hmm.
And then after 10, then we ask them to come in for a meeting. 15, we have another meeting. We remind them that, you know, if it continues, then we're probably going to go to court petitions. And the letter D means, yeah, we're starting your court petition already. But it's chasing, you know what I mean? We're chasing the whole time.
Sure.
And oftentimes the letters, B and C letters, sometimes go out at the same time because they just keep accumulating.
The 10 and the 15 absences letters.
Right. Yeah, they just kind of start piling up. Because we do the letters. We were doing the letters every 2 weeks. We still are. But it's a little bit more proactive now.
Yeah.
We've been able to identify a core group of kids. We have, you know, we have partners that are coming to our campus. The kids and the, you know, if we bring in the families to talk with the counselors, the outside counselors, like from Holly Kupa, and it's here on campus, and it's not like you got to go into Lihue in the courthouse. It's a little, we're trying to break down that barrier and make it really like we want to work together. We've always wanted to work together, but try not to make it so scary or adversarial.
What was the old practice? Once you get to court, what would happen then?
Usually takes a while for them to come up for a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So once the court petition is filed, then student and parent goes to court, and they have to keep going to court until, it's like every week or every couple of weeks until their attendance does improve, and then they're released from the program.
If the attendance doesn't improve, what is the recourse? What does the court then do?
They keep coming back. They keep getting reminded that they got to be in court. And after you know, the pressure gets put on the parent.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, if it still doesn't, my experience has been if the student still doesn't get to school or doesn't, you know, it doesn't improve, then for some of them, they end up going out of school and they go try and do a GED. The court tries to find other programs for them to, other ways for them to try and finish their education one way or the other. I mean, we don't ever want to drop them, but we want to try and figure some way that we can salvage them or try and help them to understand how important it really is to finish what they started.
Once you're in the court system, that tends to be, sort of a one-way street, I would think.
It just gets more and more
complicated, yeah?
Definitely. It does get more complicated. It doesn't make it easier for them to get back to school a lot of times. It just becomes like another barrier, you know? It's hard. They already, at that point, they don't like school, and then they got to go to court about it, and it's rough.
At some point in this pilot project, you've got to, I would think that you have to address some pretty basic attitudes on the part of the kids, the repeat truants, yeah?
Yeah, you do, which is why we're trying. I think that's why I like this program. It's not just us who are working with the kids. It's us, meaning the school, the counselors, or the vice principals. It's we have some really good partners with Holly Kupa, and they have, sometimes kids hear things better from somebody else than they do from people that they see all the time. That's what's valuable for us.
Mahina Angwai is the principal of Waimea High School on Kauai.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine and Hawaii Pacific University.
If you've always dreamed of being a Honolulu Police Commissioner, now's your chance. There are two vacancies on the commission at a critical time when it needs to be getting about the business of selecting a new police chief. Several people have reportedly turned down the job already, and some are wondering if the mayor isn't deliberately excluding qualified candidates. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair has more in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Hello, Chris. Happy Friday.
Oh, good talking to you. This is all your fault, right? The media is putting too much attention to this.
Well, the mayor's spokesperson actually said that on the record, said having too much intense media coverage of the police commission has scared off potential commissioners.
Must be true, then.
Well, there's no question that there's been intense media coverage. I'm proud to say that Civil Beat has helped to lead the charge. We think, however, it's very important. This is the only independent citizen-led agency body to oversee a police department in the entire United States, and we think that's very important. I mean, listen, the police commission is involved in some very serious business, not just choosing a new chief, but remember they agreed to that buyout package for Louis K. Aloha, the former chief, $250,000 in taxpayer money. There's issues involving police officers wanting to have their legal fees covered. And HPD in particular has had a number of problems with morale, with scandal. And it's the police commission's job to put things in order.
Yeah, as you said, Chad, citizen-led. And in the past, the police commission has been, a place for friends and cronies and political campaign, particularly friends of the mayor's, right?
That's exactly right. And, of course, that is the mayor's prerogative. The city council does have to approve, and they usually just approve accordingly, whoever is appointed. But with this particular commission, all this stuff has really come to the fore. Give credit to Mayor Caldwell for picking Loretta Sheehan and Stephen Levinson to be on the board. They were picked within the last year, but now we have two more vacancies. And remember, Max Sword, the chair, had to recuse himself because his wife is related to one of those seven finalists for the police chief. So you're down to four. And by the way, it's a seven-member board. You have to have four people agree. What if the four of them cannot agree and it's a split? So that's another concern that we need to – there's an urgency to get somebody on the commission right now. The vote on a police chief is expected later this month.
And that's got to get – the police chief's got to get four votes, even if that means – even if there are only four members on the commission, right?
That's correct. It has to be unanimous, and I can tell you that those members don't necessarily all see eye to eye. At least they haven't in past issues before the board.
Any chance of getting new members before that critical vote takes place?
It is possible. It's only October 13th. I did hear from one source saying that they thought the mayor had found someone. This is not confirmed. But we do know that the mayor's office says he has been trying very hard to find someone. Again, people are turning the job down, but I heard some inkling that maybe there will be a candidate. We'll see. No promises, but that certainly would help the commission do its work.
We've heard this argument before with regard to the rail project. The reason we have problems is that you guys are covering the story.
Well, thank goodness we're covering the story, Chris, because that's our job. We are the fourth estate, and I'm just going to stand up for journalism today.
Well, you can hang your head in shame, Chad. No. Thanks very much for talking
to
us.
You too, Chris.
You are, I guess, mea culpa. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair. And it's Friday, and this is a good time to check in with HPR News Director Bill Dorman about stories in the hopper in the newsroom this week.
Yes, indeed.
And medical marijuana is making its way into our lives.
You know, it's a continuing story, and yet another headline coming next week. This about a new entrant to the medical marijuana purveyors, suppliers here on Oahu, Noah Botanicals. But part of what they're looking at is increasing the use of medical marijuana for military veterans suffering from PTSD. Wayne Yoshioka, who, as you know, is himself a veteran, sure, spent some time in Afghanistan, is going to take a closer look at this, including some perspective from the veterans on this. In some of his early reporting, he's found that for some pain issues, there's a preference for cannabis over opioid prescriptions for pain, again, prescriptions. But PTSD, of course, something very different in terms of the conditions itself.
Yeah.
But for the treatment, this is being studied on a national basis, but this is, in terms of Hawaii, he's going to focus in more on locally. How that's going.
I would think bringing it into the military, you'd run into a collision between state and federal laws as well.
Exactly, and that's something that you see in other cases as well. But with the military, that's more pronounced, certainly.
Sure.
And, yeah, playing out, seeing how this is actually the reaction from the folks in the field coming in through the vet centers and elsewhere in terms,
yeah,
of Hawaii.
Yeah. Good story.
Yeah.
And also looking back on history, always like that.
Yes, exactly. I do as well. So next month, 100 years since the death of Queen Liliuokalani, and a number of events marking that. The centenary of her passing approaches on November 11th. Noe Tanigawa has been looking at some of these so far. She's going to be continuing to do that. Some other perspectives coming in on the Queen's personal life, a bit more putting her into the context of the times for Hawaiian, how the relevance of her life has lingered to today.
We'll be hearing more about that. Mm. And, of course, you always keep an eye on Asia for us.
You know, it's a favorite of mine. And two very different political stories coming next week. So Japan has a parliamentary election coming a week from Sunday. Shinzo Abe's Liberal Democratic Party is expected to win big, putting him in a position ultimately to become Japan's longest-serving prime minister. That'll be next year. And the other one in China, Xi Jinping convenes the Communist Party Congress. The most important political event in China happens once every 5 years, setting him up to consolidate power for the next 5 years. Going to be a lot of looking at tea leaves and parsing details,
yeah,
from that. So that'll be an interesting week.
Things that affect our lives far more than we give them credit for.
That,
well,
is true. That is true.
Thanks very much, Bill. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. And it's Friday, which means we read your letters and emails. After last week's interview with the Hawaii Community Development Authority on the closure of Kaka'ako Waterfront Park, Rose Darling on Maui said, "Sadly, we all saw this coming, and what a paradox to see gentrification right across the street with multi-million dollar condos and businesses catering to the affluent. So much for workforce housing in Kaka'ako." On Wednesday, following our call-in segment on bike sharing, we got this from Kurt Butler on Maui about riding on sidewalks. "Bicyclers may not exceed 10 miles per hour on sidewalks, must yield to pedestrians, and are not allowed on sidewalks in business districts. On Maui, these laws are completely ignored by cyclists. They violate them even when there's a bike lane 2 feet away on the road. I was once clobbered on a sidewalk by a hit-and-run bicycler and suffered a concussion. Hit-and-run cyclers cannot be held accountable because they aren't required to have tags and there is no way to identify them. Consequently, pedestrians have no safe place to walk. All the enthusiasm for bicycling and emphasis on the rights of bicyclers has been at the expense of pedestrians."
Hi, my name is Jenny, and I'm calling from Kaimuki. And my thought was three-wheel bikes for folks who can't ride two-wheelers, and also accessibility for, you know, handicapped people or people with special needs. That's my call. Thank you.
Tiare from Honolulu also wrote about bike share, saying, "I'm happy to see more bike riding and encourage even more increased use. Once my kids learn to bike well, we'll do it regularly. Along with more bike-safe infrastructure, I hope there is bike education for both bikers and car drivers. Your guest, Lori, mentioned streetlights as something that slowed her car commute, but as far as I understand, bike riders are supposed to follow the same laws as cars. Whether you're riding on the street or on the sidewalk, bikers need to obey traffic signals. I lived in Berkeley, which is a bike-friendly city with many bikers, but it was common for bikers to blow past stop signs and streetlights or jump back and forth between the street and sidewalks, which I found unsafe.
Hi, I'm Nancy Wood, and I'm calling in regards to the helicopter route that this group is proposing. And I'm all against the helicopters flying over people's places. And when they fly over mine, it's terrible. And I just realized if they change the route to flying across the coast a mile out, I'm going to be the one that's hearing all of those. So I'm just hoping that the people that live along the coast aren't going to be the ones that get to fall back this big positive change.
Thank you for your feedback, all of you. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. You can't go far in the professional surfing world without a sponsor, as we were reminded just last week when Quiksilver pulled its sponsorship of the prestigious Eddy Big Wave Tournament. Today's surfing world is a kind of balancing act between the soul surfing ideal and the demands of a multi-billion dollar business. We asked Peter Westwick, co-author of The World in the Curl, an unconventional history of surfing, for his perspective.
Partly it's not, partly that surfing has been commercial for a long time. I mean, it's been commercialized and used to sell things for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
But there has been obviously the rise of a specialized surf industry in the last 40 years or so, I guess, since the 70s with, you know, firms like Quiksilver and Rip Curl, and then others that kind of sprung up, Billabong, mm-hmm. The ones that kind of dominate the sponsorship of pro contests now. I mean, the surf industry itself really only got big enough to sponsor contests in the 80s. And before that, it was, you know, like beer, tobacco companies were the ones that were sponsoring the initial contests in the 70s when the Pro Tour first came about. But there is now this kind of symbiosis between the surf industry and contest tour. And the big wave side of it is a whole different, this kind of subset of both the contest and the surf industry now.
Well, it's now the products that being that sponsor are surfing related products, right? Board shorts, boards, accessories of various kinds, as opposed to beer and cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what was new in the last, 30, 40 years or so. Because you had, surfing was being used to sell stuff, but since the rise of the surf companies, the stuff that was being sold was stuff for surfers, but then also, marketing this stuff to non-surfers, because the surfing market is fairly big, but where these companies really make their money is selling stuff in department stores in Topeka, Kansas.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, at the root of it is the spread of surf culture well past areas where there's any surf, right?
Right. Yeah. First of all, the spread of surfing itself. So surfing has now gone global, and there's surf communities everywhere. Iceland, Ireland, Israel, Japan, Peru. I mean, there's Indonesia. There's, hundreds, thousands of surfers all over the place. So that's a substantial market that's grown a lot. But there's also the whole thing about, selling surfing to all these landlocked, especially teenagers in suburban malls in, Minnesota or, for that matter, Munich or Moscow.
Well, you have the whole notion in surfing of soul surfing as embodied by people like Duke Kahanamoku and the late Eddie Aikau. And how do you hang on to that ideal when the reality of being a surfer, if you want to surf all the time, is you're going to have to get yourself a sponsor, right?
Right. Well, that's been the trick for the surf industry and for the surfers themselves all along, is how to balance these two kind of competing images of surfing. I mean, surfing kind of has a split personality. There's this, you know, surfing is this very wholesome, healthy, middle-class, commercialized, technological sport, you know, very modern modern pursuit, modern lifestyle. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you have this very kind of countercultural, rebellious, subversive aspect of surfing. Of it's, you know, it's all about being out and communing with nature and kind of turning your back on modern society.
Yeah.
And that's for surfing itself. But then the surf companies have to kind of walk that line between, you know, being mainstream, you know, billion-dollar multinational corporations, but at the same time trying to maintain their kind of countercultural subversive image, you know, stay close to roots.
You see that in the ads. You know, you can be an iconoclast and a rebel by buying our product.
Yeah, and if, you know, the taglines and these ad campaigns are, you know, only a surfer knows the feeling and these kinds of things, soldiers of fortune, these things. And the surf companies, but at the same time, this is a, you know, very highly polished Madison Avenue ad campaign. So,
well, what's
being backed by, you know, again, these billion-dollar multinational corporations. So the companies are trying to walk a fine line between, you know, getting too big and selling out, but at the same time, trying to make a lot of money, so, and keep their shareholders happy.
Well, what they're really peddling is that kind of an outsider image, as you said.
Yeah, and surfing provides access to that. I mean, and ultimately, really, part of surfing's appeal is always tapped into its roots in Hawaii and Polynesia more generally. Is this very kind of romantic, you know, kind of a counterpoint to all the industrial trappings of Western civilization, all that, and it's this very kind of romantic, pure pursuit out there in nature, kind of unmediated encounter with the natural environment and just pure fun.
Is that, you think, the source of its appeal, you know, the sale of Surfing Magazine on a magazine rack in Des Moines, for example?
I think so, part of it. And that goes back to, you know, the first, you know, Western encounters in Polynesia, where they saw the locals, you know, riding waves on these plank boards, and it's just, wow, look at this. This, all they're doing is just the pure pursuit of pleasure. I mean, there's quotes exactly to that effect. And all they're doing is trying to have fun. And I think that appeal of surfing has persisted throughout, whether it's, you know, the original Polynesians or the Beach Boys on Waikiki in the 10s and 20s and 30s, the last century, through to today. And the surf companies are, I think, trying to tap into that appeal, and the appeal is real. But the companies are also using that now to sell product.
In your book, you look at the pre-contact Hawaii history of surfing, and for one of the things you have in your book is that there was a lot of gambling in surf contests, you know, back in the day, way back in the day.
Yeah, well, I was just about to qualify what I was just talking about, and that's surfing has never been really just divorced from the wider society around it, whether it was gambling or expressions of power by the royalty. Gender relations is another huge aspect which persists to this day, including mm-hmm. in big wave surfing, by the way.
Yeah.
So surfing has always been, you know, deeply embedded in the world around it, has never been really divorced from it, and has never been this unmediated encounter with nature by an individual, because it's just surfers have always been part of a broader society. So whether it was the, you know, ancient Hawaiians or, you know, kids today, it's you're always part of, you know, the world around you. And that includes today this commercial side of surfing.
So it makes it tricky to hang on to that spiritual aspect as it gets more commercialized and more complex, I would think.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's tricky for the individuals and it's tricky for the firms involved to continue to kind of maintain, you know, it's not entirely a fiction. I mean, they are presenting this image, but there is a kernel of truth behind the image, because you do go surfing, and when we were doing the research for our book, we had this just tremendous experience at Waikiki, where we'd been in archives all day at the Bishop Museum, fantastic resource, and then at the end of the day, we went down. And we were down on Waikiki, and yeah, you're looking around and there's, you know, these high-rise hotels all around you and the trappings of the tourist industry and this kind of Disneyland on the beach. But then we took our boards and paddled out, and the water was warm and the sun was setting behind us, and Diamond Head is glowing purple, and it was the waves were super fun, and we just had this just amazing experience of the sunset surfing out at Waikiki. So it was still, you know, the elements of the romantic, fun sport were there, even amid this, you know, manufactured tourist landscape.
Peter Westwick is an adjunct professor of history at the University of Southern California and the co-author of The World in the Curl, An Unconventional History of Surfing. In today's Backyard Quiz, we went looking for the name of a great American novelist who spent time in Hawaii while writing letters back to the Sacramento Union in 1866. His letters explained his adventures in Hawaii, which included sitting on the Iolani Palace lawn before it was built in 1882, watching 2,000 Hawaiians grieving by torchlight for Princess Victoria Kamamalu, the king's sister, on the eve of her funeral. He shared his visit to the family crypt of the Kalakauas and successors to the Kamehamehas, and he spent weeks covering the Big Island on horseback. The author also attempted to master the art of surfing, later writing, "I tried surf bathing once, subsequently, but made a failure of it. I got the board placed right, and at the right moment, too, but I missed the connection myself. None but natives ever master the art of surf bathing thoroughly." Chances are you've heard his name or read his books in school, but you may not have known that Samuel Langhorne Clemens, better known by his pen name Mark Twain, spent time in Hawaii. And Malia Ka'ai Barrett knew that. She was the first of several to know that. Our listeners were quick to respond with that well-known name. Malia Ka'ai Barrett of Honolulu is our winner today, and that's our quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Travis Meadows had a dark view of life, colored by illness, alcoholism, and loneliness.
You know, it's the glass half full or the glass half empty, and I was always like, who drank my water?
His new album, First Cigarette, tells his story of darkness and discovery. That conversation, the latest on the California wildfires, and all the news, Saturday and Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning from 5 to 9. It wasn't broken. Support for today's programming comes from Ballet Hawaii. An all-female New Zealand cast performs Mana Wahine, a fusion of contemporary dance, theater, and film, Friday, October 27th at the Blaisdell. Ticketmaster.com.
Few of us have had an opportunity to step inside the experience of Micronesian immigrants to Hawaii. Theirs is a close-knit community that has had to face a challenging adaptation to American life, a story that's told through personal testimony in the Honolulu Theater for Youth production, Masters of the Currents. Jaceline Ifanuk is one of the young performers in the show, and she spoke with us about coming to Hawaii at age 8 from her home island of Chuuk.
Back home, everything is done around the family. So, like, work, you know, working on the lands, gathering of the food, everything was done around the family. So we really didn't, as a kid, I didn't feel like I needed more time with my parents or an adult. Whereas here, now, survival mode, like, we're always working. We're working to provide a roof over our head, food on the table, and that's where it kind of takes away time from the family, because now working is somewhere where the kids can't tag along, so the kids are either at school or at home while the parents are out working odd hours.
Really shakes up the family unit then.
Mm-hmm.
You came here at the age of 8. Was it quite a shock make that transition for you?
It was. There were some shocking moments. And looking back now, I really felt like I was walking blindly. Like, I'm not even sure how I did it.
Probably one day at a time, I would think, Jaseline.
Mm-hmm.
But it was tough.
It was.
Is that what your friends and family said, similar experiences?
Yes. Yes. We've had similar experiences, pretty much what they would tell you. It was tough.
What has participation in the play meant for you?
For me, it was coming in and sharing stories and then putting them into motion. Pretty much tell the stories. They had exercises for us, so it didn't feel like we were just telling them what we went through. It was very creative. And so at the end, it was like healing almost.
The whole idea of cultural identity when you move away from where you were born, is it tough to hang on to it?
At times it were, but I was fortunate enough to still have family, the elders who were still trying to keep the family together, regardless of their working odd hours, they still try to put the family together, bring us together, and they're always talking about our cultures, things that we are missing. And then I participated in a lot of community activities. We have the track and field every summer, and those were, you know, instead of just hearing the elders tell me, it kind of gives me a chance to also live it. We all have our differences, different cultures, different traditions, and they're all very beautiful. Like for our people, we've taken a like to Korean dramas and Bollywood movies, and I realize it's because when we see other cultures, we think they're, you know, very beautiful and cool, and that's the way I see it with our culture. Like every culture is beautiful, and just taking, you know, just understanding it and seeing it and taking pride in that.
So do you think that something like performing in Masters of the Currents can kind of get people thinking in a different way, make a change that way?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And it's especially for the youth too, like where, you know, we go through so much hatred and just for looking the way we look and wearing the clothes that are so much a part of us, to see it in a different light, I think that makes a difference.
Jaseline Ifanuk is a cast member of Honolulu Theater for Youth and Teatro Productions world premiere staging of Masters of the Currents. It opens tonight at 7 at Tenney Theater at the Cathedral of St. Andrew in downtown Honolulu, with additional performances tomorrow at 4:30 and 7 p.m., and a final American Sign Language interpreted performance on October 21st at 4:30 p.m. To learn more, visit the Conversations Facebook page.
When the local mall closes up shop, it can hit a city pretty hard.
Someone told me the other day, who was a lifelong Columbus resident, that at 5:05 p.m. you could shoot a cannon on Broad and High and not hit anyone because it was that dead.
I'm Adrienne Hill. How the city of Columbus turned that abandoned mall into something green. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, right after All Things Considered.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and this is the point in our show when Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in the community a little under the radar. And here's a chance to dress up like King Lear for Halloween. What an interesting idea.
Yes, the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival presents its multi-theater costume sale tomorrow, and award-winning costumers will be available to help you choose your favorite Shakespeare Shakespearean costume.
Uh-huh.
This sale benefits local theaters. It's from noon to 5 p.m. in the Arts at Mark's Garage tomorrow. Can you believe that?
It'd be nice to see some Lady Macbeths and some Richard III's out there.
Right. You know? Perfect for our island lifestyle,
exactly.
too, walking around like that.
Exactly. And there's a finance workshop for women in midlife on Maui.
According to a recent UH study, older women are 57% more likely to live in poverty than older men. And to address this concern, AARP Hawaii presents Women and Money, Secure Your Future, a conference aimed at helping Maui women make decisions to strengthen their financial future. It's from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the Kaunoa Senior Center in Paia, and you can register on our website.
That could really make a difference for some people.
Oh, yes.
Here's a chance to hear the music of the flute.
Yes, if you love flutes, go to this concert tomorrow at UH Manoa. Ula Suoko is originally from Finland, and she's an international solo flutist or flautist and will headline this singing flute concert. The concert will open with a shakuhachi flute performance, and then Ms. Suoko will perform a dynamic multi-flute presentation. She's, I saw a picture of these flutes, so you'll be amazed if you go to the Orvis Auditorium.
Yeah, there's alto flutes, baritone flutes, bass flutes, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Who knew?
It's at 5 p.m. tomorrow in the Orvis Auditorium, and go to our website for tickets.
Thanks very much, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar, and you can always learn more about them on our HawaiiPublicRadio.org website. That's it for this week. Coming up next week, we're going to look at a growing problem of abandoned vehicles in Honolulu County. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, go to the Conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday.